Yeah, and so I guess that normally this is when Mike says something pithy and hilarious.
And now I'm AJ shaking my head, thinking what a stupid ass my brother is.
Yes, welcome everybody to the Exploding Barrel Podcast, Friday, June 4th, 2010. We got it right on the first try.
Yeah!
So,
yeah, how much better we are than the Minottis.
Yes, you may have noticed already that your usual hosts are not around. They're in Disneyland somewhere. So, in a redux of last year, Chris Whittington,
hey.
Pete Davidson,
hey.
And me, Mark Whiting, are going to pinch hit for the Exploding Barrel this week. And same show as we normally do. We have the news. Then we're going to do the quiz. We're going to have a Let's Go Topical segment, hopefully, where we round up and talk about some of the stuff that's been going on lately. Then we're just going to talk about our week in gaming. And that's that, boys.
All right.
So.
Sounds good to me.
How are y'all doing?
Good.
Fantabulous.
Fantabulous.
Yeah.
Y'all psyched for E3?
Not really.
No, me either.
No, me neither.
I've actually heard a lot of this over the wire in the last little while. Anybody I know who's actually going to E3 is filled with dread, and everybody else is kind of like,
yeah.
I'm not even going, but I'll still be reporting on it, and it's going to be, oh my god, another game with motion control, what a surprise. Oh my god, another 3D game, like, oh my god.
Hey, is Grub going?
I don't know, actually.
Got to check with him. But this is the first, I was telling you guys in email earlier, but this is the first E3 that I'm actually not excited for. I'm kind of worried, actually, because, I don't want to see my beloved gaming industry kind of morph into this big budget blockbuster 3D motion control whiz-bang fest that everybody seems to think is going to be happening, and so...
But think of the casual gamers, Chris. Think of the casual...
Yeah, I was going to say, how about Farmville? You want to see a mod made for that?
Yeah, okay, well, I know. That's
I'll tell you what I want to see. I want to see more microtransactions, please. Thank you.
Hell yes.
All right,
we'll talk...
Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Pete, you got any news queued up for us?
I have, yes.
As our official combo.com newsman.
Yes, look at me, all professional.
With the certificate and everything.
Yeah. And they're not even all stories that I write.
By the way.
That's right, combo with the K.
Combo with the K.
Home of fine people like Jeff Grubb and Pete Davidson.
Yes, you're awesome. And these aren't even all articles that I've written, so get some love for those.
Congratulations.
Thank you. See,
showing some selflessness. Selfishlessness. Whatever. Selflessness, that's what it is.
Yeah, whatever. That's what I'm looking for.
Selfishlessness could also be a new word.
I like selfishness. We can do
that. I'm definitely in favor of it. Okay.
That's why Pete's a writer and I'm not.
All right. Number one. We have a trailer for Deus Ex 3.
Which dropped today.
Yes,
apparently.
It did.
And I noticed Twitter blow up now. Am I weird in that I did not immediately go out to see it? I try and stay in the dark as much as possible when it comes to trailers. So, but everyone I know says it's awesome. So.
Yeah, I've only just watched it, but it's very spectacular. It's very, very cinematic. And it's got a real sort of Blade Runner vibe to it. So rather than the sort of blue leather Matrix look, it's very Blade Runner-ish.
Tell me they kept the theme.
I didn't hear the sort of normal theme in there, but it's got the same sort of synthy sounding music in the background. But I didn't hear the theme.
That's good. I want that square wave synth to make a comeback after Mass Effect 3. So
yeah,
or Mass Effect.
Yeah. So
everyone's very excited.
Yes.
Did you ever play Deus Ex, Chris?
Yeah, I did, but I wasn't feeling it. I was the one who was poo-pooing on how it didn't age very well, and
you just hate fun, don't you?
I do hate fun.
Yeah.
Well, according to Jeff Parsons, you know, I've always hated fun. So,
well, so does Jeff.
Jeff hates fair, other people having fun.
Yeah, he's the Francis of the squadron. Game, so, He would probably be proud of that. So, is it third person, first person, Pete?
The trailer doesn't show any gameplay. It's all cinematic stuff, so there's no gameplay stuff in there, unfortunately. But it sort of gives us an idea of the look and the world it's going to be. The story looks like it's going to be revolving around human augmentation, but sort of as well as like nanomachines, it's actual sort of mechanical augmentation of humans as well. It kind of suggests that the main character might get more and more mechanical bits as he goes through from the look of things. But, it certainly looks very, very interesting.
2027, right? That's the year it's set in?
Yeah.
Very close. Very near future.
Yeah.
Be interesting to see.
Be interesting to see if I have a robot arm by then. But, there you go. All right. Next up, then, is Infamous 2 has been officially announced.
Are we excited?
Are we excited? I don't know.
Are you? I can tell you I'm disappointed it's not Sly Cooper 4.
Yes. You're not the first person to say that today either.
We're going to be a bunch of grumps on this podcast. I can already tell. Well, I have a friend who swears, me too, swears by Sly Cooper. You know, great writing, hilarious characters, Saturday morning fun. I just didn't feel Infamous the same way. So, you know, I'm glad. I hope Sucker Punch can do well with it, but...
Yeah.
It's another bald guy.
Yeah.
Angry goatee.
Yeah. Well, the only thing that's really been released so far is some artwork that's going on in July's Game Informer magazine. And they have changed the look slightly. So, I mean, he's not bald for a start this time. He's just got very short hair. And it's quite a colourful picture as well. And there's people trying to speculate on where it might be set now, because it's set in a new city. And there's a few little architectural features and stuff and things in there that kind of suggest to some people that it might be set somewhere like London. So that could be quite interesting.
Yeah. Right on. But, so, you know, as long as Cole decides to use some throat lozenges to get rid of that dumbass Batman voice he has...
You'll then be all right with it.
I'll probably give it a roll. And if they can help reduce the motion sickness I get when playing the first one.
I really liked the gameplay of Infamous, but I just felt let down by the narrative, I guess, which is, you shouldn't get your hopes high, but they really pulled a bait and slash, like a dun-dun-dun ending at the end of Infamous, and it wasn't a good one either.
Yeah.
So, let's hope they can bring it around. I have faith in these guys.
Yeah. Let's hope so. Cautiously optimistic. Again. All right, number three then. Red Dead Redemption is getting some DLC on June the 22nd, which is cooperative missions, and it's free.
All right.
Which is good.
Good.
I like free.
Has anybody actually played Red Dead Cooperative? I mean, I've been playing a lot of time single player.
I've played a little bit online. It's quite a strange experience, actually, but it's good fun. Me and Jeff Moss of Captain Carnage played a little bit, and it's quite good. You have to kind of make your own fun a little bit, because it's not entirely obvious what you should be doing or where you should be going to begin with. I mean, there's no sort of structured missions and stuff. There's areas where you can go and kill things and try and do it as quickly as possible, and there's journal challenges like you've got in the single player, but other than that, it's a case of make your own fun. Although it is quite fun to go on a bit of a killing spree, see how much bounty you can get, and see how long you can survive for. Because when you
did notice that there were a lot of places in the single player game that looked like they'd be really awesome co-op like levels, like forts and stuff like that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Most of the major towns, when you go to them in multiplayer, there's some signposts you can go to start like a deathmatch or a team deathmatch there as well. So. The free roam by itself is quite interesting, and it's got a peculiar leveling up mechanic in there as well. So,
hey, Pete, what version
form is
are you
this
playing?
DLC?
Sorry, say again, Chris.
Go ahead. Let Mark do his question, and I'll pop in with.
I was just going to ask what form the DLC is in that's coming. Is it a new town or?
Let's see what it says here. So, co-op DLC, which lends more structured missions to the World West Sandbox's existing online multiplayer mode, has been dated for June the 22nd. Red Dead Redemption's existing online multiplayer allows players to compete in several deathmatch variations in other standard modes. As of now, there are no real co-op missions. Bandit hideouts throughout Mexico and New Austin, which are fully explorable in multiplayer, constantly refill with new gangs of bandits to eliminate. That's what we got at the minute. So what there's going to be now are six missions from the sound of things, which are more structured, a bit more like the single player missions. It's sounding a bit like, did you ever play the GTA 4 co-op missions?
No. I'm a bad co-op player.
Yeah, the GTA 4 had some co-op missions that were completely separate from the rest of their game. They were pretty good. So I'm guessing it will be something along those lines. So you'll start a match and you'll say, I want to play co-op rather than I want to play free roam or whatever. But that's all we've got on that for the minute. But June the 22nd is when that's coming, and it's going to be free, so worth checking out. Okay. Right. Next item I've got here is one big game, the non-profit publisher who brought out Chime on Xbox Live Arcade a little while back. They've got a new game on the way. It's called War Is Not the Answer, and it's coming out for iPhone and iPod Touch, and it's done by the guy who came up with Parappa the Rapper, who is very excited about it.
Is it also a charity type of thing?
Yes, One Big Game's whole thing is that all their stuff is non-profit and for charity, so this is going to be another charity game. They haven't released any figures on how well Chime did yet, because they're still counting up where it's gone and what they've spent it on and so on, but we should hear some figures back from that within a month or so. And this new game is going to be a similar thing, and with the kind of game that Chime was, which is just a sort of quick play, fairly simple thing, that's going to be a good fit for the iPhone and the iPod Touch, I think. So,
right on.
Nifty.
Okay. We have some box art for Dead Space 2. If you're into that sort of thing.
Does it have two fingers stretched skyward in a Left 4 Dead 2 style?
No, it doesn't. It does have a big helmet, though. It's very closely focused in on Isaac's helmet, which is suggesting to a lot of people that the game is going to focus quite a lot on Isaac's psychological condition as well as the monsters as well.
Yeah, I saw the teaser trailer, and I thought it was kind of stupid. Just the way that they're going for the story just seemed very Me Too,
Dead Space is weird, right? Because the story was totally generic. But I really enjoyed it. It was a game, like, I didn't expect to like it, and I ended up liking it a lot. I think it was sort of I was willing to forgive it its genericness for just how polished it was. So I'll probably feel the same way about Dead Space 2. It's a bit of a guilty pleasure. I'm a little bit of a game snob, but yeah. I still like Dead Space. It's quality stuff, so yeah. I'll probably pick it up.
In a side note to that, there is a rumor that Dead Space Extraction is coming to PSN and Xbox Live Arcade as well, which should make.
Yeah, I saw that, and that's good. Maybe they'll actually sell a few copies then.
Yeah, exactly. So it'll piss off Wii owners who bought the original version for full price when everyone else buys it for $15 in HD. But apart from that, it will give a lot more people the chance to play it. So that'll be good. Because that was supposed to be good, wasn't it?
Yeah, everybody liked it.
Yeah.
But
it was an M-rated game for the Wii, which, never sells. So
true Bummer. Enough. All right. Okay, we have another rumor. This one's just for Mike. We have a new WWE game on the way, which is apparently going to be a Legends of WrestleMania sequel.
Yeah, and that rumor is only for Mike, by the way.
Yeah, that is just for Mike.
The last time I cared about wrestling, Hulkamania was still running wild.
Yeah,
it never run wild before.
This is the thing. It's been pointed out that Hulk Hogan won't be in that because
forget it.
Yeah, because he's wrestling for a rival organization now, so he can't be in WWE games anymore.
Wait,
so.
Isn't he like 100 years old?
Something pretty much.
What do they do? Is he Big Boss now or something? Like,
he went and hopped on to what wrestling organization? I know Mike's yelling at me right now.
TNA.
But, TNA, yeah. And he's supposed to be like the guy who's going to be dropping all the business consulting ideas onto him, which I don't know what brilliant, gems are going to come out of his steroid-riddled brain, but we'll see.
Nice. Anyway, in other news about sweaty men, Sony have banned porn from the PlayStation 3.
How do they expect to grow?
Great segue.
How do they expect to move technology?
Yeah, exactly.
So how has this done exactly?
Well, they're not banning it from the internet, obviously, but the studio Vivid Entertainment, who make naughty movies, were trying to get some of their movies on the PlayStation Store, and Sony shut them down. So, so teenagers everywhere will have to go back to doing it the old-fashioned way, rather than purchasing their porn through the PlayStation Store.
Oh, but now their moms will be able to find out.
Yeah. Okay. So that's nice. And then finally, I think this is quite an interesting piece of news. This Lord of the Rings Online, the MMO, is going to be going free to play in the fall.
Good for them.
I saw that today. Now, what's the fine print on that?
What's
the rationale?
I don't know if you're familiar with Dungeons & Dragons Online at all.
I'm familiar with Dungeons & Dragons, not DDO, but yeah. I know it. It has been free for a while,
yeah.
Right?
Well, yeah. Lord of the Rings Online is from the same developer, and they've obviously had some success with Dungeons & Dragons Online, which was actually quite a good game as well.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. The fine print is you get the game for free, and then you pay for... I can't remember exactly what they called them. It was something like performance-enhancing items or something like that. And yet, then you can...
I get enough email for performance-enhancing items as it is, you know.
Yeah. But then you can also buy for expansion packs and quest packs and so on. So it sounds like there should be a reasonably good free core game experience there. They haven't released the full details yet, but the estimates are you should be able to play up to about level 50 for free, and then after that you need to start paying for content to get anywhere, buy the expansions or these quest packs and so on to carry on progressing.
Is there a revenue model for people who don't go that far? Like, how are they making money in the first 49 levels?
From the sound of things, these items, so it'll be things like the sort of items that you get in, I don't know, stuff like Mafia Wars and so on. So there might be better equipment that you can buy for real money and that sort of thing. If you look at games like the stuff that Area Games does and the stuff that Acclaim does now, I mean, those are all free to play all the way through. But most people will buy at least a couple of items there to give them a slight edge over the challenges that are there. Otherwise, it gets very difficult. So you're not actually locked out of content in those games, but it's just very difficult to achieve anything if you haven't bought stuff.
Right. They'll dangle the monsters in front of you, and then they'll punch you in the head.
Yeah, pretty much. Character. Pretty much, yeah.
That sounds like a winning strategy.
Yeah. the model that this is doing now, there's an MMO came out for the iPhone and iPad a while back called Pocket Legends, which is a pretty good little sort of Diablo-like, actually. And that follows a similar sort of model here, where the game itself is free, and you can play up to about level 15, I think, without having to pay any money for it. And then as you proceed through the game and level up, you just buy a new episode that will give you maybe another 10 levels worth of gameplay or something like that. And if you don't want to play anymore, you just stop buying episodes for it. And that way, if you want a complete experience, it will take you all the way up to whatever the level cap is, then, yeah, you've probably paid the price of a full-price game by then. But if you just play up to level 15 and you say, well, I don't want to play anymore, you're not as out of pocket as you would have been if you'd bought the full thing. So I think, it's an interesting approach, I think.
Good luck to them. Yeah, I mean, there's got to be other models for MMOs out there. And if you can give them away, it seems to be working well for Korea. So
yeah, definitely.
The micro transaction model.
Yeah. Right, yeah, that's all I've got for the minute.
Okay. And it's short and sweet, and it's that's how we're doing it in the EBP vacation time. So I have the great Pete Davison quiz,
yeah.
A British gaming quiz. Whatever. I think we'll still call it the Great American Ash Guy Gaming Quiz, but I have assembled a list of questions based around the fact that Father's Day is coming up. I thought we'd have a nice Father's Day themed suite of questions, you know, just because I don't care enough about E3 to research a bunch of heavily E3 related questions. So I'm going to throw these out as per usual. We have we've got five questions and one bonus question. So Pete, you could be Edge Guy.
All right.
Chris, you chime in.
Yeah.
So first up. Name five games released in the last 2 years in which you play a dad.
How many games?
Oh, God.
Five. And there have been at least five.
All right. Silent Hill Shattered Memories.
Yep.
Heavy Rain.
Yep.
Yep.
Red Dead Redemption. technically.
Yes.
Yep. All the God of Wars, 1, 2,
yep.
1 and 2, or well, 2 and 3, the last 2 years.
I'm still only giving you 1 point for that.
Yeah, nah, whatever. Oh God. I bet Mario has a lot of illegitimate children out there. It's got it.
I saw a really. Yeah, I'm not going to bring that
be
up.
True.
I saw a wonderful animated gift to that effect. I was counting BioShock as part of this, but that's
no, because
you're playing a big daddy.
But you're not a father. See what you did there. You don't have a child from your loins. You just have the name daddy.
I'll give you guys full marks for that.
Yeah.
I think there's actually more. If you went into the realm of RPGs and stuff, you could come up with more. But the dadism has been a theme in the last couple of years. So, Keith, question 2. Knight family, as in Gabriel Knight, with a K. Knight family fathers die when their children are at what age?
Oh, God. I've just played that scene the other day as well.
73.
This is a tradition. No.
Oh, damn.
You got it?
No.
The answer is 8.
Ah.
I thought for sure you would get that one. All right.
What a drag.
What character's quest to save their father made a magazine ask, and this is a big cover, a big ad, can a computer game make you cry?
That's Heavy Rain, right?
No. No. Possibly.
No. You know what I'm this is an older one, isn't it? Is it King's Quest 6?
You're very close. Go back another 2 instances. It was actually The Perils of Rosella.
Oh, really?
And there was a big... Yeah, this was a big deal at the time because they had a big, like, 8-bit ad that they used to run in, you know, Computer Gaming Weekly or whatever that had... They had that tagline, can a computer game make you cry? It just had a big pixelated Rosella head on the front. I do have a Heavy Rain question, though. Number 4. What is the minimum number of trials that you can complete in Heavy Rain and still save Sean?
1, I think, isn't it?
I have 3.
It'd be pretty hard for just one, unless you played it again.
I'm just thinking of the ones that you have to play through. You have to do the bear trial, don't you? The driving one. But the other ones you can avoid, I think.
You can avoid them, but you won't save Sean at the end.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I think the minimum number of saving Sean alive is 3.
Hmm.
I'm willing to be wrong. But for the purposes of this quiz, I'm going to count it. Question number 5. This should be interesting. Name a JRPG character who has both a living father and mother.
Whatever.
This took us a while at supper time to answer this question, but there are answers out there. I almost said that has a living parent of the same sex.
Wow.
A living mother.
Cue
and
radio
mother.
Silence.
That's crazy.
No, because they've all got at least one that's dead. Normally both of them.
We played a lot of JRPGs. If they are alive, it's always the opposite sex parent as well.
Whoa.
All right, Pete. You can do at least one JRPG character who is a parent of the same sex.
Parent of the same sex.
Alive.
Well, I was actually thinking... Aerith from Final Fantasy VII, but that wasn't their real mum, was it?
No.
No. Shit.
I don't count, you know.
Why do the Japanese people like their parents dead?
I don't...
Do we count Jekt from Final Fantasy X?
I'll give you Jekt.
Yeah?
He's a dad. He's sort of alive as a giant Godzilla thing. The only character that I could think of that has a living father and mother in a JRPG... there's Kaim from Lost Odyssey, where you play as a living father.
Yeah.
But in Last Remnant, which I know that both of you love so much, the main character there actually has a living mother and father. And that was the only one that I could think of. There might be more, but not very many.
Hmm.
All right. Bonus round. How many traditional Mario games feature Bowser Jr. and Bowser? by default.
Dude. It's all you, Pete.
Oh, God. I'm nowhere on my Mario lore, and I can feel Mike yelling at me right now.
Is there really such a thing as Mario lore? Come on.
Come on. There is in Mike's world.
These are traditional Mario games, so I'm not counting kart racing, I'm not counting golf or anything like that. Pick a number. It's less than 10.
And you're not counting RPGs?
I'm not counting RPGs.
I'm saying 4.
Right. I'm going to say 3, just to be arbitrary.
There are 5.
Damn it!
Oh, God.
Actually. Sunshine, Super Mario Sunshine, the new Super Mario Brothers, Galaxy, Mario Brothers Wii, and Galaxy 2. There you go.
All right.
Now we know.
Now you know, and knowing is
G.I. Joe.
I could also have asked you how many kids Bowser had, but I think there's 7. Anyway. That's your Father's Day quiz. You're all bad fathers.
Well, yeah, I knew that already.
So here we are. Let's talk about this.
Okay.
I have a let's go.
Whatever you say, buddy.
I have some let's go topical. I was thinking about whether I should just go off on a complete random tangent since we're steering the show this week, but I thought I'd stick to a subject that Mike has done in the past. So I have a couple of let's go topical questions out there. How many of you guys have played Alan Wake?
I have.
I have not yet.
You have not yet. Do you know about Alan Wake's DLC strategy?
I've heard about it.
I saw you ranting about this the other day, though.
But I will. I just need an excuse to rant about it somewhere, so this podcast is going to be where I rant. So here's my question. Alan Wake's DLC strategy will ultimately be successful as a means of preventing significant numbers of trade-ins. Yes or no? And so, Pete, I'll give you the framework here. When I boot up Alan Wake right now, the first thing that I see on my screen when I go to push new game or continue is two great big panels that show the DLC. They show the first one is called The Signal, and then the second one is called The Writer.
Right.
Writer's not available yet. The Signal will be available in, like, 50 days or something like that. And so I have a particular hate on at the moment for this because I finished Alan Wake and then proceeded to rant on Twitter for several days, as you probably heard, on this subject. They, in my opinion, they end the game, but they leave a hell of a lot of questions up in the air. And the way that they're dealing with this is that they have bet that you are willing to stick around long enough for them to answer the questions, that you will not trade your game back into GameStop for 50 days to get the first part of it, and then an undisclosed number of days to get the second part of it. And so it struck me as something that we should just talk about. Mm. So this is the first instance I've ever seen of a company actively holding back, like, a plot element in order to hook guys like you and me who care about that sort of thing. Rather than, you know, we've all seen the Mass Effect DLC or other types of DLC in the past, like extra maps or whatever. This is the first time I've actually encountered a trade-in incentive that both angered me and would have prevented me from trading in a game if I tended to do that sort of thing.
Right.
So I wanted to float it.
Is this paid DLC or free DLC?
It's 800 Microsoft points, but you get it free if you've bought a real copy of the game.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. I'm not sure it'll work, to be honest, because I think their timing is too long, because most gamers these days are very impatient, and if they're going to play a narrative-based game like Alan Wake, as soon as they finish it, if they're going to trade it in, they're going to trade it in straight away, and 50 days is a long time to wait. So I'm not convinced that that's going to work.
Yeah, for me it was like the story equivalent of Blue Balls, right? You come to the end of the game, you're like, oh my god, yes, good, now I want to see how this plays out. Sitting there, I personally had the large, you know, extend-a-book edition of Alan Wake sitting on my table. So I figured I'd already dropped $100 or whatever on the content. I wanted to see how the story ended, and I ended up staring at a screen that said, 50 days from now, we'll tell you the answer. So, A, immediately super vexing, and B, I was like, this trend better not take off.
Yeah.
Because if it does, I'm going to go down to Silicon Valley and sucker punch.
I don't think it will. Yeah, I don't think it will. I mean, that is pretty ridiculous. I think the only kind of DLC strategy that I've seen that I approve of, even though I didn't like it being mostly a game renter these days, is EA and how they handled the Cerberus network with Mass Effect 2, and then how they're going to be moving forward and doing a similar kind of feature for their EA Sports games, where you buy the game new and you automatically get online play and access to exclusive DLC and things like that. But you get that. That's bought. You know, when you buy it new, that's yours, right? And if you just rent it, then you got to drop, what, 15, 20 bucks, something like that, on the little code to input into your Xbox Live account. And I think that's totally fair. I mean, I think that's a great deterrent for buying used as opposed to buying it new. But yeah, what they're doing with this is doesn't make sense to me.
Well, the critics of the system you're talking about there with the Project $10 thing they're calling it is the PC gaming's been doing that for years, especially with multiplayer modes and things like that. Like all Valve's old stuff, if you had bought like a used copy of, I don't know, Half-Life or something like that, then you can play it online. If you didn't have the CD key, or if the CD key had already been used by someone else, you couldn't play the multiplayer modes. So PC gaming has actually been doing this for a very long time, and no one seems to be mentioning that when they're criticizing it.
Hmm. Yeah, I had a difficult, like, it upset me, because unlike every other type of DLC that I've seen in my life, it was something I actually cared about, as opposed to the, you know, Kasumi. I mean, Chris, did you ever download the Mass Effect bonus DLC and see that other party member character or get into her
story?
No, I never did.
And from what I understand, none of the DLC characters are really worth the price of admission, so I'm kind of glad that I didn't sweat that out.
And have either of you guys played the Dragon Age DLC?
Yes, and that one, you're talking about the DLC where you pay like $7 and it gives you something that should have been built into the game. It gives you like a chest where you can keep your loot.
I think I'm talking about like the actual going back to what I'm talking about is going back to a game like Dragon Age, which is a really long game that you spend a lot of time with and are invested in, and then you walk away from it for a couple of months and then have the urge to go back.
You know what, Dragon Age. The reason why I don't... Okay, here's the way my brain works. If I buy a game like Dragon Age and loved it, which I did, I'll play through it once, and I'm mostly a play-through-once kind of player. And then I'll put it on the shelf, and then when the DLC comes out, it's like, that's cool, but I'll just wait till it comes out a little bit lower, because what they do is that if you wait long enough, which it's not like there's a shortage of games out there to play, right? I mean, it's not like I'm, you know, putting all of my gaming chips into this pile, right? I got other things that I could be doing. What I can do is, if I could just wait, I can buy, and this is what I'm going to do with Dragon Age Origins, is I'm going to buy the Game of the Year edition where they put all the DLC all on one disc. I'm probably going to get it through Steam so I can play it on my new Mac and just play through it that way. That way there's long enough time in between my first playthrough and the second playthrough to where I've forgotten enough to where it can be kind of a new experience for me.
Yeah,
and I had the sense with Alan Wake, it is so much like a TV series that I ended up thinking of it like, you know, when encountering this situation, I have encountered this situation before in real life when I want to watch a show that's on DVD, and what I normally do is wait until the entire season is out on DVD and then watch the show.
Yeah.
So this is the first instance in a game format where I've run into this, and it's been like, you know what? If this ever happens again, I'm going to wait till the DVD comes out.
Yeah.
Well, which is the most ridiculous business proposition I've ever heard. Hmm. If what they want to do is not make me trade it in, what they've effectively done in the future is guaranteed I'm not going to buy it for 6 months.
Yeah.
Which is not exactly what I think they want.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, Dragon Age, I do want to go back and play Awakenings, but like Chris said, there's so much stuff around at the moment that I just don't have time to at the minute. But if I get to a quiet spell, then, yeah, I probably will pick up Awakening at some point. I still want to go back and play all of the Fallout 3 DLC as well. I haven't played any of the DLC for Fallout 3.
Yeah, me either.
And I really want to pick out the Game of the Year edition and play through all of that, because I loved Fallout 3. It was brilliant, but I haven't touched it since I finished it for the first time.
Yeah, that's exactly how I... And it's funny, because I was trying to think about games that I would drop $60 or, like, you know, a full price on, and it always revolves around the high-profile RPGs, like the Bethesda games, the BioWare games.
Yeah.
Like, I bought Dragon Age Origins. I waited a couple weeks and I got a good smoking price on it. But I mean, usually I will buy that just outright because I know that I'm going to buy it, I'm going to dig it, I'm going to put in enough hours to justify my cost. And that's the same thing too with Fallout 3. I'm waiting for the Game of the Year edition. And right now here in the States, it's still $60, which is the regular price for a new game. And I'm waiting for that sucker to come down to 40.
Here.
You know,
same here.
Yeah.
On a similar note, okay, I've got a question about this. So, you guys, if you follow my tweets, you know have been a big proponent of Deadly Premonition.
Right. Yes.
I don't know, your brother Pete wrote an interesting story about this, but Deadly Premonition, possibly the best shitty game that's ever been made, was number, on the opening week of May, I believe, it was number one on the Amazon sales chart. Amazon released Deadly Premonition for $15 and it snaps the insane things.
Mm.
And it shot up to the top of the charts, above Call of Duty 4, Call of Duty 4, above all the other stuff there, only for a week. But it got me thinking on the about the idea of the price points of games, and also the idea of originality versus... how do I articulate this? Okay, so the question is, where on the sliding scale of money and awesomeness does originality become a liability rather than a benefit? So let me rephrase this. There's a game on that I was just reading about today called Skulls of the Shogun. It's an Xbox Live Arcade game, fairly standard, turn-based strategy kind of thing, set in a wacky kind of chop-socky Chinese vampire movie looking, just a really crazy aesthetic. You know, the kind of thing that you'd buy for, well, I don't really care about the game per se, but hey, hopping vampire game, right? DLC. This is a downloadable game, something like, what was the one that we saw at PAX that was all cel-shaded and stuff? Very original looking. Very
Shank?
Bloody.
Oh, God. Yes.
Shank, yeah. So, on one hand of the scale, you have original titles like that. And like I also count Deadly Premonition in that camp, where the tech might be shitty, but it's original, and you'll pay for that. And on the other end of the scale, you have Alan Wake and things of that nature, which are very polished, very somewhat lacking in the. Or you would say that if Alan Wake had taken too many risks, it wouldn't be probably the success that it is. So I wanted to float a question out there about the price point in games, and do you think that there is the $15 price point is a more reasonable business model, or is an underexplored business model? Mm. Let's put it that way.
Well, when I think about this, I think about back in the 80s and the early 90s when you used to get games that went straight onto budget labels, and very often they were really good games, but they... You'd play them and you think, well, okay, yeah, this isn't worth full price. But they go straight onto these labels. There were companies like Codemasters did straight-to-budget games on the Atari and the Commodore 64 and so on. And that carried on into the 16-bit era on the Atari ST and the Amiga and so on as well. And there were a lot of great games there, but the developers and the publishers knew that they were not shitty games, but not as good, not as high-budget, maybe not as polished, maybe not as long as full-price games. And they released them at a lower price point, and that worked really well, I think. Because you see a budget game on the shelf, and you think, oh, okay, that might not be quite as good as like the latest hotness or whatever, but you might be more inclined to make a bit more of an impulse buy there and try it, something that you might not have done normally. And what you say about the Amazon thing there is, that price for Deadly Premonition got down low enough that people were thinking, yeah, I will check that out. Because Deadly Premonition is one of those games that a lot of people have been talking about. I mean, although, I mean, it's not necessarily sort of particularly critically acclaimed or anything like that, but all over Twitter and blogs and things like that, people have been talking about it, even if it's just to take the piss, but a lot of people have been talking about that game. And so it made a lot of people want to check it out. And $15 is obviously a cutoff point for a lot of people that made it an impulse buy. So, yeah, I think there's definitely scope for exploring that.
Yeah, I think $15 is a good, that's a good impulse buy for a game for me.
Yeah, I noticed that Alan Wake, since we're still talking about it, last week it debuted in, or when it debuted in Europe, it debuted at number one, but it's down to number 13 now on the NPD numbers, and it's dropping quickly. And so do you guys think that, I guess Alan Wake would have been more successful as a $30 game than as a $60?
Well, yeah, I think it would have been more successful since they basically didn't give you the real ending, you know, and then just make you pay for additional chapters to finish up the game later on. I think that would have worked out a lot better.
I remember Gabe Newell at Valve's saying something about how the actual price point for a video game is more along the lines of $15 to $20 rather than $60 to $100.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. I have a statistic. This is a discuss. There was a big study that was released today by done in conjunction with the NPD group that was talking about the habits, gaming habits, and, you know, the average age of the gamer these days is apparently 33, you know, how many hours they play online. And one of the things that this survey revealed is that there is a marked difference, a generational gap, if you will, between older gamers our age and younger gamers. Older gamers are buying in large amounts offline, single player, probably mostly RPGs, but the experience, the lion's share, I guess, of the single player offline experience is being sold to people ages 25 and up.
Yeah.
And the younger generation, millennials, you know, Farmville players, are also buying a lot of games, very much, you know, multiplayer focused, online friends focused. And so the question is that demographic trend, considering who has the purchasing power right now, is that demographic trend going to hold steady? And as gamers age, do you think the older gamers will continue to drive the offline single player experience, or is that mindset going to be subsumed once these millennials outnumber older gamers in the purchase?
I think we're kind of looking at a snapshot of now, like the gaming market the way it is now, and I can tell you that a lot of people from 25 and up, it's just a time situation, you know. You can't get together regularly with your buddies on Xbox Live 4 to 5 nights a week when you have a family or a job, or, you know, when you have other kinds of, you know, quote, adult-like responsibilities going on. I mean, that's what I run. I would love, I mean, absolutely love to play a lot more multiplayer games. I just can't do it. I can't line myself up with my friend. And besides, you know, like you guys, you're all over the country, you know, and so then we got the time zone thing working in our against us, and so that just makes it really difficult. So I'm kind of in a position to where, well, I'm just going to have to buy and play some single player games and just get together with you guys and just talk about them afterwards, you know, which that's fine too. But I mean, yeah, I mean, when you're a kid and you're in college and, you know, you're you got nothing but time, you know, to do that kind of stuff.
I guess the question is more along the lines of, do you think that older, more financially, you know, stable or whatever, gamers will continue to be enough of a purchasing block that they will support that model in the industry 10, 15 years,
I see what you're saying.
In the future?
Yeah, I think so, because, I mean, if you consider how much games have expanded as a medium in the last 20 years, that's continuing to do so. I mean, games are expanding way faster than movies did, for example. The audience, the diversity in the audience is expanding a lot quicker than when movies started and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think there's it might splinter off into smaller markets, though, and it will be more obviously segregated markets. I mean, we've already got the supposed casual hardcore divide, so I think we'll start seeing more splinter groups like that. So there'll be more people who focus on the sort of competitive, quote-unquote, sports games, like Modern Warfare 2 and that sort of thing, that people just buy to play competitively online. And then at the same time, there'll be, for want of a better word, mature gamers who will want that single-player story experience. Just like when you look at the DVD section of your local Best Buy or whatever, and there's a section there of stuff for kids that's all very short episodes and all very in-your-face and that sort of thing. And then there's a selection of sort of mainstream movies for people, and then there's a selection of sort of things that people like us buy because they're interesting or because they do something a bit different and that sort of thing. And I think the rate that games have been expanding over the last few years in particular, I think there's always going to be a scope for all those different things to happen, particularly with downloadable services as well.
Yeah, it seems to me that, you know, as we were joking about Farmville at E3 coming up this year, you know, people our age are all likely to roll our eyes and say, oh my God. But at the same time, the older demographic is maintaining a very strong purchasing block. And it was interesting to see the data back that up.
Mm.
So, I don't know if there's more to say on that subject. Here's an easy question. 2 years from now, we'll still be talking about Natal and PS3. About PS3 movie.
Hmm.
3 years from now? Two years.
2 years from now.
We'll be laughing about it, I think. I mean, I think...
Virtual Boy, or...
I really appreciate what they're trying to do. I really do. But, man, this is not the economy to roll something like this out. I mean, who is going to want to buy a brand-new frickin' TV, all-new peripherals for an aging console? I mean, this is just bad. It's really, really bad. So,
I actually find it quite difficult to predict what's going to happen with them, because they, both Sony and Microsoft, to an extent, especially Microsoft, have been so tight-lipped on what these things can actually do. I mean, we've seen really relatively few demos of both of them. And if anything, I think there's been a lot more demos of Move than there have been of Natal. So I still don't really know what Natal does. And we probably won't know until E3 when we finally see some games for it. I mean, can you name any Natal launch games, for example?
Yeah, no, not at all.
No, didn't think so. But you probably can't do the same for Move either. But I think Move has got a bit more of a chance than Natal has, because it's a bit more familiar to people by actually having something in your hand, whereas people are going to feel weird standing there in front of their telly with just a camera. But, 2 years' time, I'm not sure. Unless they pull something really special out of the bag, then, yeah, I'm not sure we'll still be talking about them.
All right, last question. Chris, have you played Red Dead?
Like an hour of it.
Okay. Now, maybe we won't ask this question. How about it was about collectibles. But you did play Alan Wake.
Yes.
Did you collect thermoses and...
Yeah, I did collect.
And that kind of stuff. Did you care?
I didn't actively go looking for them, but like, well, no, I'm lying. I did go actively looking for them. So if I missed a few, I didn't care. But like, if I didn't feel like the shadows were on my ass or something, and I could go, you know, take a side little view and see if I could find one here or there, yeah, I'd find them. That was kind of cool. But honestly, and this may sound stupid, but I kind of got bored of finding thermoses.
Here's the direction this question is heading. I've been playing a lot of Red Dead over the last couple of weeks. I've been very satisfied running around looking for treasure hunting with maps, and digging up herbs, and shooting rabbits, and hunting various wildlife around. And in a way that, in Alan Wake, which I also just played, finding coffee thermoses, radios and whatnot frustrated the shit out of me and made me upset. Whereas in Red Dead, I love it. So I guess the question is, what is there a right and wrong way to do a collectibles?
I think for Red Dead Revolver, I think it's appropriate because it's a very much kind of slowly paced game where you can just kind of go out and take your time and do whatever you want to do, whereas Alan Wake, you're panicked all the time. And I don't want to go searching around for stuff when I'm panicked all the time.
It seemed very natural to me to be the one of the things I really like about Red Dead, and we'll talk about this more when we've got, you know, our weekend gaming or whatever, is the idea of just like the you know, GTA has that 100 packages that you have to pick up, or the pigeons or whatever in town. Hunting, foraging, these things are really a lot more naturally integrated into Red Dead in a way that makes I think makes them really work. It makes them compelling as a game element. And Alan Wake, not that the little Bright Falls, Twilight Zone TV show things that they were doing weren't awesome, but they have, like, let's be clear here. There's over 100 thermoses. There's 25 radio things. There's 25 TV things. There's a little more than 100 pages to pick up of the story as you're walking around. And each of those pages, it contains extra detail. It contains backstory. Like, they're good as far as the pickups go. But it just really pissed me off. And I could sense that what I think they were trying to do was extend the life of essentially a single-player experience, and maybe hope that you wouldn't trade the game in as quickly if you were trying to walk around looking for pages to pick up.
Yeah.
And something just struck me as very wrong about that. I think it was as well as you could do it as a pickup in a game like that, but it was still a bad idea.
Yeah, I think in sort of narrative-based games like Alan Wake and so on, that I mean, I haven't played it, but is it fairly linear to go through?
It's the there is a linear direction that you move through, although the levels themselves are not, you're not on rails. There's quite a bit of wander room
in the
game. The game really encourages you to explore the environment and kind of poke around looking for these things.
But there's still essentially a sort of path to go down eventually.
You're moving. You're moving direction. You're moving from point to point to point in the story.
Yeah, whereas something like Red Dead Redemption or even GTA and that sort of thing, I mean, yeah, there are missions to go and do, but between those missions and things, you feel a lot more free to go off and explore things. So I think in that kind of game where there is that freedom to go off and explore and you feel like you should be exploring rather than getting on with the plot, I think collectibles in that sort of thing are a bit more acceptable, for want of a better word. And I agree, Red Dead Redemption integrates them really nicely by putting them in some sort of thematically appropriate context as well, like the hunting of the rabbits and stuff like that. That's to make you better at shooting and that sort of thing. So yeah, Red Dead does a really good job of that, I think.
All right, well, that's the only this is the only talking points I've got queued up for today. And we should mention, by the way, that Chris has left to go pick his wife up. So Pete,
yes,
you can be Mike and I'll be AJ, or vice versa. Let's talk about our weekend gaming.
All right. Shall I go first?
Yeah, sure. You've been playing a lot of Blur, I see.
Yeah, I've got three games I want to talk about. I want to talk about 3D Dot Game Heroes first.
I can contribute to this conversation.
Good. Which I've played a little bit of. I actually didn't know a huge amount about it before I got hold of it, but there were like two copies in the whole of the city where I live, so I decided to pick one of them up before it disappeared off the face of the planet.
I'm glad you were able to find it. Did it cost you full price?
Just under. So,
okay, because over here they're selling it slightly reduced. I think it's about $10 or $15 less than another PS3 game.
Yeah, it was like £5 off here. So normally you'd pay $39.99 for a new game, and it was $34.99, I think. So it wasn't a huge amount off, but I mean, first thing that struck me was I wasn't expecting it to be quite that retro in its presentation. Like, I got into the character editor, and it was just like a Nintendo menu screen, and it was great because there was.
Did you build your own?
Oh yes.
Hero.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
I built a little me with a massive head.
The first thing I did was sat down and built my D&D character in DOTS, and then I went on and built other characters in DOTS, and I got really excited when I heard that Atlas had set up a website for people to upload their heroes and download other people's heroes. Because I was thinking that it was going to be kind of a Spore deal, where, you know, there was a Dotopedia and you could, like, populate other enemies and stuff into your game. No. No, that's not how it works.
No, I think that's a real missed opportunity, actually. And I think they should have at least put in the opportunity to share your hero with your friends in there. That would have been nice. But, I mean, it's easy enough to do because you can just put the save file on a memory stick or something like that and then upload it. So I mean, you can do that. But, yeah, I was impressed with that. And then I was impressed with quite how Zelda 3 it is, because I just started playing. I was like, this is Zelda 3 with the mirrored map.
Yeah, I couldn't believe when I started playing it that they were able, From Software was able to do this without getting the shit sued out of them by Nintendo of America. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, but as you walk around, there are Tektites, Octoroks,
yep,
those centaur things,
yep,
from Zelda. Like, every creature that's in The Legend of Zelda, the mummies in the dungeon,
yep,
they're literally, you know, palette swapped and,
yeah,
and 3D-ified.
Yeah.
There's a boomerang. There are bombs. It's Zelda.
Yeah.
It's straight up. Like, at what, you know, as Tycho and Gabe said, at what point in time does it stop being a, is it an homage or is it a ripoff? Well, you know, do we like it? Then it's an homage. Do we hate it? Then it's a ripoff,
well,
right?
I do like the fact in 3D.GameHeroes that it is wonderfully self-referential all the way throughout. So there's Demon Souls jokes in there where you find someone has scratched something on the floor of the dungeon and that sort of thing. There's dead heroes that are all making references to their run button not working and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
so
there's a ton of Demon Souls references,
yeah,
in that game. I've picked up the sticky white stuff.
Yeah.
There's the From Cave where the From developers are frantically working on some sort of mecha game. That's an Easter egg, by the way. If you go and talk to those guys between each dungeon, you can eventually unlock something. I'm not sure what exactly, but it's wacky.
Yeah.
I like it. I really like the music.
Yes, I do, actually. It's got a really nice sort of mix of synth instruments and chip tunes and stuff, so it works really nicely.
It's kind of like, you know, when you booted up Mass Effect 2, you didn't know exactly what you wanted the music to sound like, but you had a good idea of what you wanted,
yeah,
80s or 70s sci-fi to sound like.
Yeah.
And in the same way, I think that sounds like Pixels.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah,
like
definitely.
Orchestral Pixels.
Yeah.
So I'm a fan.
Yeah,
I
really like the presentation generally, actually. Just little touches, like when you're outside and you move from the foreground to the background, it's got that lovely sort of shifting, tilt-shift focus effect where the foreground goes out of focus as you move towards the background and that sort of thing. So there's loads of really nice subtle touches in there.
Yeah, and I had something to say. It's quality work. Now, I have been playing it quite deliberately in small chunks.
Yes, me too.
I found that it's a really good game to play. If I play anything too close to, like, sleeping time, I'm too worked up to go to bed.
Yeah.
So I have, like, a 45-minute block near the end of the day where I want to just put in a relaxing game, and 3D.GameHeroes has been perfect for that. It's mindless. It's low maintenance.
Yeah.
You just walk around, hit things with a great big ass pixelated
sword. I love the sword. The sword is hilarious.
The size of the screen, and play it in small blocks. I remember Jeff saying when he was playing Final Fantasy 13 that he thought that as a game that you played in small chunks, it was a lot more successful than actually sitting down and blasting through it.
Yeah.
End to end, so.
I agree it's a good game for small chunks. I'm not sure about relaxing, though, because there's a lot of those dungeons that I've sworn a great deal at. But, yeah, it's definitely one to play in small chunks. And it's paced quite nicely between them as well, so you can have a short session and feel like you've achieved something. Like, the dungeons are big and reasonably challenging, but you can probably do them quite quickly, just like you can in the Zelda game, so if you know what you're doing.
And there's an almost infinite ability to just screw around in the overworld.
Yes.
If you want, which is also very Zelda-like in its philosophy.
Yeah. Alright, so that's that.
Thumbs up on 3D.GameHeroes.
Yes.
I'd be careful about recommending it to people. I feel like it's the kind of game you should put a bit of a caution on before you sort of universally endorse it, because after you scratch the surface, it's really not that deep or engrossing. You know, you have to be ready to like Zelda on its own terms.
Yeah.
And if you're expecting anything other than that, you're not going to get it.
Yeah, definitely.
It is what it is.
All right. The other two I wanted to talk about, but kind of go together almost, is Split Second and Blur, which, and I know Mike and AJ have been playing Split Second a lot as well. So,
So as a non-racer, as a person who does not have either of those games, describe the difference to me.
All right. Well, Split Second is the kind of game you'd get in an arcade. It is an arcade racer. It's very silly. It's all big skids and things exploding and doing things against time limits and that sort of thing. It's very sort of bombastic and dramatic and over the top and ridiculous. And you play it and you're either be screaming or laughing all the while you're playing it because it is just so stupid.
But this really impressed you guys at PAX.
I mean, it's just fun to play because it's very simple and it doesn't need to be any more complicated than it is. I mean, even the game interface is kept really simple. I mean, it does an outside car view by default rather than an in-car view. There's no head-up display apart from a tiny little bit that hangs off the back of your car that tells you just the very bare minimum information you need to know for the mode that you're playing at the time. So in some modes it might have a score floating behind your car. In other ones it might have like your time or your position or whatever. But it's very, very minimalist and it just makes things feel really simple and uncluttered. It means you can just concentrate on racing or whatever you're doing. And it's just fun. And it's a real sort of white-knuckle thrill ride all the way through. And in fact, I think it's entirely appropriate that Disney published it because it feels like a ride at a theme park. Because you're driving through these environments and you're seeing things and you think, right, okay, well, something's going to happen there. And then suddenly it does. Like this ocean liner will crash over onto your head or something like that. Or this building will fall on you or things will explode and that sort of thing. And just all the while you're arriving, it's the kind of game that makes you really grip the controller really hard just because you know that shit is going to happen all the time. And in fact, there's one mode, the sort of equivalent of the time trial mode in there. It's not a normal time trial around a lap. What it does is... Around each map, there are areas called power plays, where when you've built up enough power by doing skids or drifting along behind cars and that sort of thing, you can set off these bombs, basically, which make the buildings explode or cars go flying across the road or change the track in some cases. And the time trial mode, what it does is it automatically sets off every single one of those just ahead of where you are. So you're driving along and you're having to avoid all of these things blowing up around you, and it's just ridiculous, but it's a lot of fun.
You get extra points for doing that. I mean, I guess that is the point, right?
Well, I mean, the point is still to win races and so on. But the blowing chaos. Stuff up is it's what you have instead of like a boost in burnout or something like that. So you blow something up when it's next to someone, and it gives you a chance to wreck them. So if you blow something up and it knocks, say, a big truck across the road or something like that, and then your opponent can't get out of the way fast enough, then they'll get wrecked and you can go sailing past them. So you have those instead of weapons or boosts or anything like that. So it's quite an interesting approach, and it seems to work quite well. It's the kind of thing that could easily be quite unbalanced, but it does seem to work very well.
Blur,
on the other hand, Blur, I mean, the best way to describe Blur is what they did their advertising campaign based on. Blur is Mario Kart with real cars. that's all it is. So it's got a bunch of licensed cars. It's got tracks from various places around the world.
So these are licensed cars, but with power-ups.
With power-ups, yeah.
So you're driving a BMW with a missile launcher.
Yeah, you're driving a BMW that can shoot missiles, which is awesome. But it's got a really nice aesthetic to it as well. It's got very much sort of Geometry Wars 2 style, sort of glowing neon aesthetic to the whole thing. It's got a great soundtrack. It's very, very polished. But the best thing about Blur is it's got this wonderful social side to it as well. All right, a blog post.
I've heard about connection problems with it.
I haven't experienced anything like that. Although I've mostly been looking at the single player stuff recently, but. I've played a bit of multiplayer, but the big draw with the social thing on there is that they said that they wanted to do a good social game. And you think of social games and you think of shit like Mafia Wars and Farmville, which has no actual gameplay and just has excuses to send messages to your friends.
Yeah, my friend, game designer friend, refers to those as game-like activities.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas what they've done with Blur is they have created a good game first and then wrapped all the social stuff around it rather than doing it the other way around. So they put together a really solid driving game, a really solid racing game with power-ups and so on, and then they wrapped all this social stuff around it. So And Bizarre have always been pretty good at this with like their leaderboards in Geometry Wars 2, and even going back to Project Gotham 2, they did this as well. They had leaderboards with all your friends on and that sort of thing. But they've just taken this to a new level with Blur, in that you finish a challenge in single player, and what you can do then is you can then send a challenge to any of your friends on Xbox Live or PSN who are also playing the game, and it will send them a message for the next time they start the game up to say that, oh, so-and-so has challenged you to do this better than them. So it could
be something on your Facebook updates that was like 46 tries to do a particular challenge.
Yeah, that's right. So if that person accepts that challenge, they can then do it. They can accept it, and then they then have to try and complete it within 7 days. And if they do it, it tells the other person how many times it took them, and they have the option of sending a re-challenge then. So you can keep going back and forth with this one challenge and just trying to keep bettering your score over and over again, just like we did with Geometry Wars 2.
Right.
The only trouble with that is it's enormously distracting from everything else the game's got to offer, because there's a lengthy single player mode, there's the multiplayer mode, which is completely separate and has a very sort of Modern Warfare 2 style leveling up and unlocking system in there that works really, really well. But as soon as you get a bunch of messages in from your friends, you just know you have to beat them then and there.
Yeah.
And if you get a lot of those in, then it just becomes very difficult to make any progress. But yeah, it's a really solid game. It's worth noting as well that it's got a really good four player split screen mode as well. So you've got four player Mario Kart style racing with real cars that works really well and really smoothly. So
have they actually done any couch matches with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it is just as fun as Mario Kart used to be, and it's got the racing modes, and it's even got a battle mode like Mario Kart. So yeah, they've done a great job on it. I'm just concerned that although it's been getting good reviews, I'm just concerned that no one's buying it and no one's playing it, because I looked last night on multiplayer mode and it said there are only about 1,500 people online playing multiplayer, which is a bit sad, because it's a really good game that more people need to play.
That's a little bit surprising. Maybe they haven't done the Geometry Wars Blur connection quite as strongly as they could have.
Maybe.
I mean, if people outside of the community might not be up. I mean, I knew about some of the things you were describing, but this is sort of news to me.
Yeah.
Good stuff, though.
Yeah, definitely. It's a really solid game. So what have you been up to?
I've been playing all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's been forever since we podcast, so I don't know. What am I going to talk about? I've been playing a lot of Red Dead.
Yep.
The last couple of weeks. I've been fairly monogamous. We have Alan Wake. I went from Deadly Premonition to Alan Wake, which is its own show in itself. I'm definitely trying to round up enough squad members who have also played Deadly Premonition that we can actually do that show justice.
Yeah.
Deadly Premonition and or Alan Wake. But, yeah. You know, it's weird. It's like that time when last summer I suddenly had three games back-to-back that were taking place in Tibet and involved Purbas. And you were like, what the hell's going on? Okay, so I've gone from never being in the Pacific Northwest to playing two games back-to-back that on one hand share many similarities and on the other hand could not be more different.
Yeah.
You know, Deadly Premonition is that underdog, under the radar, god awful, ugly, horrible play control, but you just can't help but love it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just lovable on so many levels. And I don't want to gush over Deadly Premonition too much, except to say that it is a strong candidate so far for me for Game of the Year 2010. Now, I'm not, it's not like legit, reasonably at the end of the year when we get together, it's never going to beat Mass Effect 2.
Yeah.
It's never going to beat that stuff. But, you know, there are games that are released that have heart.
Yeah.
And despite their shortcomings, you are willing to forgive them so much. Like Eternal Darkness or something is a good example of this, right? Where, regardless of what you might say, that game has qualities that shine, you know, Barkley Shut Up and Jam Gaiden, right?
Yeah.
If Barkley Shut Up and Jam Gaiden was worth $20 instead of free, it would be Deadly Premonition. So there are so many similarities, and it's got that same weird-ass humor, the same WTF, I can't believe I'm doing this, quality to it. And, you know, it's great to play with somebody because they're just laughing. It's a great, you know, game to play with buddies because it's so ridiculous. And I've been watching the, actually at work, You know, I knew it was a good game because when I finished it, the first thing I wanted to do was watch the giant bomb endurance run that they are doing of Deadly Premonition. So I'd spin it in the background while I was coding at work and then get to hear them experience what I had just experienced and go, oh, my God, or, oh, this sucks, or, you know, WTF. So anyway, Deadly Premonition, fantastic. So I cut straight from that to Alan Wake. You know, one of them looks like ass. One of them is gorgeous, right? One of them is nothing but sweary, and who is the director of Deadly Premonition and his, like, word pad. The other one is so beautifully, you know, it is, Alan Wake is Suras game, S-R-S-G-A-E-M, you know, it is, it is taking itself fucking seriously.
Yeah.
In a way that that Deadly Premonition does not even vaguely try to. And I've slagged on its DLC thing a little bit, but I actually really liked Alan Wake. And, you know, Jeff Parsons also wanted me to chime in here and say that it was, it's really solid. He enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Your mileage, I think your mileage with Alan kind of varies because I have finished it. I don't want to spoil anything, but its ending is more of the Silent Hill school than the we are going to explain everything school.
Yeah.
And part of that is obviously that they're setting it up for Alan Wake 2 and 3, which have already been, you know, sort of officialized.
Yeah.
And also that there's just a ton of stuff in it that if they're not going to explain it in the DLC, they do explain it in, like, the ancillary bonus materials, which I just happen to have because I bought the Extended Book Edition, which is gorgeous, by the way.
Hmm.
That's one of the best game... you know, I don't normally go in for the Extended Editions, but this one comes with an actual hardbound book signed by Alan Wake that is full of short stories written by Alan Wake. So, I mean, quote-unquote Alan Wake, but still, there's content in the books and the peripheral materials that explains and clarifies further what's actually going on in the game and which is never explained in the game. So I really feel that, like, I'm probably a little more favorably disposed to this stuff than a person who did not also have access to those materials would be.
Yeah.
Because if there's something that's confusing, there's one character, for example, in Alan Wake, whose motivations are never explained. He shows up, they do stuff with his character, and they nowhere in the game do they ever say, here's the deal with this guy. You can get at that partially in the bonus materials, like the book that I bought and stuff.
But
it's that sort of fuzzy direction that makes me take a bit, it makes me bristle a little bit at it. Because for all of Deadly Premonition's faults, it told a really, you know, a story that I kept coming back to even long after the game was finished. And it told it in a way where it was neatly wrapped up and packaged at the end. It had enough open ends that you had to connect the dots, but it didn't leave you feeling like, I cannot stand that lost feeling, you know, where I think that the writers are just holding a flashlight under their chin and going, and hoping that you will, you know, I'm wise to that. If I'm watching a show and I don't understand what's going on, my first reaction isn't, oh, I'm so much stupider than these writers.
Yeah.
My reaction is, you're not telling the story very well.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going on message boards to look for mysterious symbols that you've hidden in the background of a JPEG artifact so that I could solve this mystery. Like, I'm just not going to do it.
Hmm.
I just finished watching The Wire. Like, they told a real story there. And so, especially with Alan Wake, it's troubling because the game is about writing.
Yeah.
And all through the game, Alan is talking about the construction of stories, the, like, Stephen King says, like, there's this quotes to the call out to all these other writers and stuff. So it's a bit like playing a game where, imagine you were playing a level designer in a game.
Yeah.
And he was going on about level design all the time, except that the levels were really mundane and boring.
Yeah.
You'd probably be like, really? You know, and Alan Wake is, I don't want to suggest that its story isn't good, because, and I mean, this says more about us than it says about Alan Wake, but, you know, compared to most game stories, it's head and shoulders above anything else. You know, they put the attention into detail, and they put work into the characters, making it so, like, they're actually telling a story that, as a gamer who is in his mid-30s, I'm not ashamed to be playing this.
Yeah.
Not that I get ashamed at your normal JRPG melodrama either. Yeah. But I mean, it's nice to have. And Alan Wake is obviously made by people who are adults for people who are adults.
Yeah.
There's its soundtrack is really, really good, and it makes excellent use of like people I haven't heard yet in the game. Like it does this episodic thing really well, where at the end of all, there's five episodes in the game. At the end of each one, they cut to a sort of, you know, next time on Alan Wake. And they're playing stuff in the background there, like Roy Orbison tunes and stuff that's, you know, like David Bowie, things that we would recognize
that's cool.
younger audiences maybe wouldn't. And it has a real televisual quality to it. So that part is really strong. But, you know, it has all the polish and all the gloss. And it, on the surface, you would think that the sum of its parts would be so much greater than the sum of Deadly Premonition's part.
Yeah.
But in retrospect, I don't think that's the case. So that's my take on Alan.
Yeah.
Still worth playing. Really enjoyed it. Haven't really said anything about the combat. It's fine. I know Chris was frustrated at it. Jeff liked it. I'm in the like it school.
Yeah.
People seem to think that there's only one type of enemy in the game. Not correct. But they do have a limited palette, but that doesn't necessarily make for bad experiences.
Yeah.
So it's worth playing.
Yeah, that's cool.
Dig on Alan Wake. Again, Deadly Premonition, $20. Alan Wake, almost 80, you know, depending on what edition you buy.
Yeah.
There's a real, where am I getting more value for it here? So that comparison thing has just been a really interesting thing for me. But I like it. It's definitely good. And then the last thing, you've already talked about Pixel Dot, which I've been 3D Dot Game Heroes, I've been playing a lot of. But I wanted to talk about Red Dead as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably like most of us, have you been playing it at all?
Yeah, I have been playing it a little bit. I haven't got very far in it yet, but I have been playing it a bit.
So what do you think? Just give me your first impressions. Like,
I like it. I mean, it's got, I haven't played that far in the story yet, so I don't feel I can comment hugely on that yet, but... Although what you tweeted about the other day about any time you're riding somewhere with someone, there's a lengthy conversation. I like that as well. It gives it a very sort of movie-like feel to it. But the most impressive thing with it, it's got to be the scale of it. Like, you're out there in the wilderness, and it feels like you are in this massive open space with nothing in it. But it's not a boring nothing. Like, you can look around, and there's vegetation around, and there's little animals creeping around, and... The fact that they populate the world with so many little random events and things, so that you're never just riding anywhere. You always come across something on the way somewhere, and it's your choice whether or not you go and do anything with that. But I think they've done a great job of actually creating a world there rather than just a level.
Yeah, I read a review of, I'm not sure who wrote it, but I think the phrase was used when describing Red Dead, that in retrospect, it should have been obvious that the best genre for Westerns is open world.
Yeah, definitely.
Right? And, you know, I'm a big Call of Juarez fan, you know, I love Westerns, but that really hit the nail on the head. Like, the one thing that Red Dead does that I haven't yet done in a game is that, as you say, you know, that sense, Shadow of the Colossus almost riding out along the prairie and having, on one hand, miles of nothing, and as you say, on the other hand, something's always going on.
Yeah.
There's a really great moment if when you get to Mexico, as you will in the game, when you cross over into Mexico, just randomly, out of nowhere, as you cross over and you're riding along the Rio Grande, the town that you're trying to go to is quite a long ride away. It's maybe 2 or 3 or 4 minutes of game time riding across the plains. And for a while there, they just cease everything. There's no events. There's nothing. You're just riding, and in the background... like a cowboy song starts to play.
Yeah.
Like a country and western, very quietly. And they just do that for about 5 minutes. They let you walk. They let you look at the scenery. And they seem to be very conscious of how the grandeur of what they've designed actually, of how that works. Like a number of times in the game, I've just gone riding up to somewhere and been blown away. Like, I've actually turned to Lynette and said, look at that. Like, and it's just things like Western landscape. You know, it'll be a river with a hill in the background, or, you know, plains with the sun setting slightly behind it, or the forest. But just the way that it's rendered and the authenticity of it. I mean, she's from Texas.
Yeah.
So as I'm wandering around, she's like, okay, well, this is West Texas, or this is close to Louisiana, and, you know, this is Mexico. And, and when you see the wildlife, like the armadillos are out in the part of the world where armadillos would actually be, that's really... it's really great, the little attention to detail. There have been one or two things about it that have annoyed me a little. Like, I spent one evening looking for skunks.
Yeah.
And that was annoying.
Like, yeah, I've had that trouble with rabbits.
There's, there's not all that many places in the West where there are skunks, and when you get the quest to skin them and, you know, bring some skunk pelts. I've been really into the side stories in a way that I never was with GTA. Like, I'm not a package collector. I'm not a pigeon shooter. But, you know, throw a quest in front of me that says kill and skin 5 deer, and I'll ride all over the place looking for them. So, as I was saying earlier in the show, there's something about the implementation of that in the game. It's not quite collectibles, but it's not collectibles either. And I really love it. My favorite part of the little mini games is the treasure hunting.
I've done three of those now, I think. Yeah, that's a great idea.
Brilliant. Part of me would love to play just an entire game. You know that sometimes I talk about the survival game that I want to play, where you're like in an alien world and you're just trying to survive? Just a survival game where they give you a map and are like, find this landform and hunt a treasure that's there.
Yeah.
Because I cannot get enough of that riding around. But, you know, all parts of Red Dead are good. It's very surprised me a lot how, I don't want to say reverent it was, but like, they're taking the idea of the Western seriously in a way that the Underpants Mayhem of GTA is not.
Hmm.
You know, I'm not shooting a rocket launcher at horses.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not riding. You can be an outlaw and ride through town shooting the place up, but for once, you know, maybe the only time in a Rockstar game, there are strong, tangible rewards to not playing like a dick.
Yeah.
If you play White Hat, you get different new outfits, you get discounts at the stores, you get people running up to you asking you to undertake side quests, like you, and you get that feeling of being a, you know, the White Knight of the West. You don't have to be a Dudley Do-Right. You can be more of a Roland gunslinger anti-hero, but you can be a good guy. And the game will reward you for that. And it's very satisfying to me to ride over a hill and, you know, gun down a couple of outlaws and then throw a lasso around one and start hauling him back on my horse while he's kicking and screaming and saying, you know, two reasonable men like us can work this out. And you're like, no, buddy, you're going to jail. You're going directly to jail, and that's how it's going to be. And I really like that. It seems... It's like such a natural fit to have this sort of good guy morality in it.
Well, I think just the look of some of the events that happened. Like, I was in the town of Armadillo one time, just sort of between missions and so on. And I was just standing there, and then just like three or four people just rode into town, just firing their guns into the air. It was just a random event that happened. But they came in there, and it's like, I've seen that happen in a Western film before. And then I took part in that, and I shot them down, and one of them wanted to have a fist fight, and that sort of thing. I was like, yeah, this is really cool. But yeah, they've obviously watched a lot of Westerns and just tried to get the look of the things that are happening right, just as much as the look of the landscape right as well. So yeah, that's off to him for that.
I've really noticed that with the writing as well. Like, the writing is very serious. Mm. It's not Sorus the way that Alan Wake is, but the characters... They take themselves seriously. It's not... There's some wacky characters like that grave-digging Seth guy who's a grave robber, and you have the medicine show man, but especially your main character, it's very odd to have a character who's so polite and so... I don't want to say neutral, but like, there's a lot of political conversation in the game. Like, the choice to set it in the dying of the West was a really interesting idea, and riding into Mexico, the revolution's going on, and having your character, to having him sort of be the guy who, rather than being the instigator of a lot of this plot, is just kind of like, he will react to things, and the way that he says them, it's very satisfying. Like, he always has a good turn of phrase, his delivery is good, and he comes off as a real coolest guy in the room kind of character. And the way that when you play Kaz... And Yakuza, Kazuma, you're like, I love playing this character.
Yeah.
Because he's always the coolest guy. I find John Marston to be the same way as a character.
Yeah, I think he's pretty, he's almost instantly likable, I found. Just the way he says things, and like you say, he's very polite, and the fact he uses sort of fairly flowery language at times, and the way he interacts with other people and that sort of thing. Yeah, he's a very likable character, I think, so they've done a good job with him.
they've done some very interesting nuanced stuff as well, like Bonnie at the ranch. I like that there's some sort of UST going on between these characters, yeah. But, you know, for once you're playing a character who is married, and, you know, it's a Rockstar game where there are whores, and you can't hire them.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that kind of a game, and I really respect it, you know. It's not the I'm beating up a hooker, taking my money back, and then running wild. It's a different sort of beast.
Mm.
I really appreciate that. I don't know what it says about Rockstar that they decided to, because I think they could easily have gone spaghetti western.
Yeah.
With this, but instead they went for more of a serious. It's not that it isn't spaghetti. Like the musical choices and stuff, especially. There's a lot of 1960s and 70s. Sounds and stuff in there, and it does evoke that. But the kind of gravitas of what's going on has been maintained intact. Some people are bastards, you know. Morality is very gray a lot of the time, but those are things that you want in your westerns.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, stark moral choices, stark landscape. There's all sorts of western tropes we could talk about, but I just really like it in a way that I really wasn't expecting to. You know, last time I heard about Red Dead, I was under the impression that it was in a troubled development cycle and that there were problems with it. And so to see something like this come out of it, I'm really impressed. And I'm still enjoying it. And, you know, just the little touches, like when you get into Mexico, suddenly all of the in-game sounds, the little stings that you get for completing a mission or the little, you know, just the little ancillary stuff.
Yeah.
They've done a complete palette swap of that. So while in Mexico, you know, it's all Spanish guitars and mariachi trumpets and little, it's the flavor of it changes perceptibly depending on where you are in the country. And it's just, it's full of little details like that. And also, I'm never going back to playing pool in a video game when I could be playing stabbing the knife between my fingers or arm wrestling or, you know, the little Mitch throwing horseshoes, you know, the little mini games that they have are just, I think there's certainly an element of, I haven't done this before in a game, whether it's shooting rabbits or herding cows in, you know, Thunderstorm or whatever. It's a real like, wow, this feels new. This feels sort of different in a way that I haven't really experienced before. So yeah, big thumbs up on
that. Yeah, definitely. Agreed.
All right, well, that's all I got to say.
Yep.
You have anything, Lester, can we, we'll put this thing to bed.
I think we'll put it to bed now. I think that's us, isn't it?
That is. So, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed our EBP pinch hit. You can catch The Exploding Barrel on iTunes or at squadronofshame.com. We are, of course, Squadron of Shame. We'll soon be releasing another podcast. I know it's been a while, but... with the deluge of games that we've had lately, can you blame us? I mean, it's we are living in the monsoon season right now, so there is going to be a Gabriel Knight show that's coming up very soon. And like I said, I'm trying to pull as many people together to do a Deadly Premonition side mission.
I would love to take part. They just need to release that damn game in Europe.
Yeah, it's. I thought it was region. I thought it was region free.
Yeah, it might be. I guess I'll have to look into
Asia.
That.
Take a look at. Or something like that. Because I know that there are as we do. So all the dialogue and stuff is in English. So it's kind of getting trouble with that. But yeah, consider it. Anyway, that's been EP for this week. So
signing off.
Yeah. Bye, everybody.